Okay, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm sorry to interrupt. We're bringing in some extra chairs. We had people came that we didn't know were coming, and I'm glad for that. And so we'll be setting up some chairs in the back here, and it's just in order to get everybody to have a chance to sit down. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS. I would like to thank you. Are we ready back there? Are you? Because I'm starting. Okay. Okay. Would like to welcome all of you. Glad that you are here. And I welcome you for what I hope is a conference about facts rather than emotion. And I say that very intentionally. This town has been drowning in emotion on the question of port security for the last 4 to 5 days and been remarkably little facts, you know, to inform this discussion. And I think it's something we've got to correct. Let me, by way of disclaimer, because of the goofy this town has become, that nobody is paying us to do this conference. I have not been paid a penny for it. I have no relationship with Dubai ports. I've never been contacted by UA. Nothing. This is absolutely nothing. We're doing this ourselves because of our Homeland Security agenda, trying to at least provide a fair venue where we can talk honestly about this issue. Now, I got to tell you, I'm very disappointed in the sort of rhetoric that's characterized the last 4 to 5 days. You know, the last phrase in our national anthem is the land of the free and the home of the brave. Well, it sure doesn't sound like it. It sounds like it's the land of the afraid. When are we going to start using our brains rather than paranoia to address homeland security? This is just crazy. And we have got to start having a sensible debate about facts. What's really going on? What did the government do? What is the relationship of the government's security obligations and what it rightly puts on companies? How do they relate to each other? How do we assure ourselves? This is all working. So in order to get at these genuine facts so that we can be the land of the brave again, we have reached out to four of what I think are some of the finest security professionals in this town, two in government and two who've been in government. And it's designed to provide the kind of dialogue, discussion that we need in Washington right now. So, David, let me turn to you. I want you to introduce our colleagues, but I especially want to thank Judge Webster and Secretary Loy for coming today. They've got a lot of things on their plate, and, of course, Admiral Bone and Secretary Ahern, I'm delighted that you could join us today. These two guys probably can be a little bit more vocal than you can, you know, being you're still in government. But I hope we make this a very open discussion about facts and what it is that's in front of this country. So, David, let's turn to you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, everyone, for coming here today for what is a very important discussion. I think one of the jobs of the panel today, as John said, is really to take the politics out of policy. And if there's any issue that needs it, it's the issue of the national security issue related to the Dubai Ports world purchase of the British company that runs current operations in U.S. ports. As everybody knows, this is an international company, billions of dollars of investments. It has operations in India, Romania, Australia, Germany, Dominican Republic, China, South Korea, Saudi Arabia, Malaysia, all over the world, and looking to work on some operations in U.S. ports, and we'll clarify some of those issues today. I think Americans really have an obligation to educate America about the difference between clear security risks and the perceptions of risks. That really, as John was saying, are based perhaps on the fear of the unknown. For example, because of security concerns, many in Congress today are now discussing legislation to prevent foreign ownership of operations at U.S. ports. Should this be our policy? Perhaps. If there are clear security concerns, we need to think about that. But also consider that over half of U.S. ports today are currently being operated by firms from countries like China, Singapore, Korea, and the U.K. And what about U.S. firms that own operations in ports all across the world? Should they then be denied ownership to places in other ports? Or perhaps we should make our policy to prevent foreign operations of U.S. firms by firms, ports by firms that come from countries that are at the nexus of terrorism. There's no question we must protect against terrorism. It is our principal mission post 9/11. But consider under that policy that the current British firm that operates at the six ports in question, they may have been banned under that policy, given that the UK has been the source of Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, and not to mention the most recent terrorist attacks in the London subway bombings from homegrown al-Qaeda. The key question we must wrestle with today is whether there are national security reasons why Dubai Ports World should be prevented from taking over some port operations. To answer this question, we must look at four key issues. We need to understand ports and port operations. There's been a lot of confusion about just exactly what this deal is. People have said that the company in question is taking over our ports. Some say they're running terminals, and others say this company will be just hiring people on the dock to work the cranes. We need to clarify this, and I think it's fair to say that most Americans have no idea what exactly is going on in a port other than to drive by and see the large cranes. They've never been to a port. So we must understand some basic facts about who owns America's ports and how are they run. We need to understand what security is in place to protect against terrorist threats. From across the sea in some foreign port when cargo is loaded onto a ship, all the way to when it arrives in a U.S. port and is unloaded, we need to understand what security will keep us safe. Third, we need to understand what the actual role the company in question, Dubai Ports World, will play in any and all port operations, and more important, in any and all security. And finally, given the Dubai Ports World is owned by a foreign government, the United Arab Emirates, I think we need to understand the implications this may have on the security of our ports and the cargo coming from them. We rely heavily on foreign investment, foreign countries, foreign workers in our workforce, in our economy, and in our security operations on fighting terrorism. And we have we have to make sure that those relationships do not undermine our security, they strengthen it. But we can't do that without a proper discussion and a fair vetting of national security issues. We have an exceptional panel here today to discuss all of this. We have to come to the conclusion of whether the Dubai deal does jeopardize our security or enhances it, or perhaps neither. The full bios of our panelists are in front of you in your kits. I won't go through all of it, but let me just, first of all, welcome these distinguished guests. We really are honored and pleased to have them. Admiral Loy, as you know, probably is the most knowledgeable person today, inside or outside government, on homeland security issues. He has a distinguished career of over 45 years of public service and was responsible for not only helping to draft our national response plan, but to help establish the Department of Homeland Security in its conception. Judge Webster, probably the foremost authority on intelligence issues, domestic, foreign, having run the CIA and the FBI, we can think of no person better to understand some of the questions having to do with the threat. And we have the two principal officials responsible for port security in the federal government today, Rear Admiral Bone and Commissioner Ahern, are responsible and on the front lines today, working in Customs and Borders and in the Coast Guard, responsible for securing our ports and our cargo. Gentlemen, welcome. What I'd like to do in terms of our format today is I'd like this to be informal. Each of our panelists, I'd like to hear a little bit about your perspective on the questions at hand, just to start off with. Then I'll begin a discussion that we will have and bring the audience into it, and we have a hard stop at 11. So welcome, everyone. Welcome, panelist Admiral Loy.
David, thank you, and CSIS, thanks for an opportunity and a forum in which perhaps we can take a little of the kerosene out of the air and substitute some water and see if we can, as John introduced this forum, talk a little bit from a factual foundation as opposed to some of the extreme statements. Oh, thank you. Some of the extreme positions that we've all watched find their way into press and, unfortunately, press folks to extreme positions, which will now be very difficult to sort of rejoin and find common ground to move ahead on this issue. A couple of points that I would just make up front. First of all, I think this notion of what a port is very, very important. In other words, to see a notion in the media that is suggestive that this transaction would offer ownership of U.S. ports to DP Port World is just an erroneous factual statement, and it has to be restated that fundamentally all that the transaction is proposed to do is take over the leases currently operated by another foreign operator, P&O, a British firm, in the six ports of concern. And what does that mean? Well, understanding the difference between a port owner or a port authority or a port operator or a terminal operator, these are all sort of terms of art that we in the maritime industry sort of take for granted and understand very, very readily. But the American public that is reading and trying to come to a conviction or a conclusion on their own as to these things can easily have these things mixed. So understanding with some degree of clarity, and these guys that work in the trenches, as David just mentioned, can help us understand that as well. But all that is going on here is that DP World is attempting to buy out the leases of six ports internal to the port operations themselves and the responsibilities of the port operator as opposed to ownership and magic words like that that can get things inflamed has to be taken to ground. Secondly, it is absolutely the prerogative, the right, I would offer the obligation of the United States Congress that if they are concerned about an executive branch decision to insist that it be explored as deeply and as readily as might be the case to satisfy themselves, quote unquote, that the right thing is being undertaken in the best interest of the United States and its citizens. I would offer that perhaps the fault line on this particular uproar. And somehow the timing is perfect. You know, when Fat Tuesday closes down last evening and we get on with Ash Wednesday and some sanity in the world of celebrations of things, I've almost wondered whether we've had about a 10-day-long Fat Tuesday going on in what we've all watched in the press and statements made by serious people, concerned people over the course of the last week or 10 days. So that congressional role is a right one. And to the degree now we have a 45-day opportunity to sort out what needs sorted out and come to a reasoned conclusion and move on from there, that's certainly what I hope would be the case. There are elements of the security question that are always on the table. I would offer that somehow or other, when you're dealing with transportation and the transportation system, and after all, the port is simply a hub in the due course of getting something from wherever it started to wherever it's going. And that is an inherent hub in a transportation system. We have found in our very serious looks at this this kind of thing over time that it's either about people, cargo, conveyances, or facilities. I mean, those are sort of the four things that if you've got a good handle on people, cargo, conveyances, and facilities, you probably have got a pretty good handle on the security implications of what the threats might be, what the vulnerabilities might be, and what we ought to be doing to minimize those threats, those vulnerabilities as it relates to American security. The last two points I would make very straightforwardly would be these. One, we live in a global marketplace today. And as John and David introduced this, the simple realities of foreign investment in the U.S. economy as a significant part of the underpinning of the quality of life that we enjoy as Americans is very real, and we should have a tactile understanding of that before we suggest such things as no foreign ownership to ports of the United States. Well, there's so many wrong innuendos internal to that notion. It's not about ownership, and it's not about total, but it is about foreign investment into the well-being of our economy and understanding those things, not at a superficial level, but at a relatively subtle level, I think would help us all be more reasonable in the positions that we're taking. And then lastly, who is responsible for security in the ports of the United States? And it's actually these two gentlemen in particular, but they're hundreds of employees, Coast Guard officers and petty officers and young seamen, Commissioner Ahern's super troops that literally around the world are interested in the security and the well-being of the citizens of this country on a daily basis. And then my last point would be what I think is still missing here 4.5 years later. Dateline 9/11, 4.5 years later. We are still missing an adequately articulated framework that takes pieces that we have stepped out on boldly, the CSI program, CTPAT program, 96 hours of notification, 24-hour manifest requirements, the ISPIS code, the legislation last year that offers Admiral Bone and the Coast Guard the direction and the responsibilities they should share. Those are all pieces of what I think is a yet-to-be-integrated puzzle. And that integration effort, which Secretary Chertoff back in July indicated was one of the things high on his list of priorities to undertake, is the work that we have to press on from here. So are there ideas that we can add pieces to that puzzle, finish the puzzle, and integrate it so that we can actually articulate what is the integrated global supply chain security system? When we are able to do that, then we will far more easily be able to see how a transaction like is on the table between DP World and P&O will or will not have a dramatic impact on that system.
Thank you, Admiral White.
Well, first off, I'll just mention when we think about transportation or global transportation, we think about it just in the same terms that Admiral Lloyd just spoke of it. But we don't look at it just as transportation of cargo when we look at threats. And we looked at an international as well as a national regime, a security regime. He spoke of ISPIS, which is the International Ship and Port Security Code that we worked through IMO to establish. We do see this as a global issue. This is something, if we're going to solve security and security in our ports and security of cargoes that come through and into the United States, we came to the realization very early that this is going to have the participation of the global community and the international community, just like the war on terrorism, and if we're going to be successful. And so the security regime places in place requirements with regard to operators, people that move cargo, people that move vessels, individuals and organizations that move people that want them to arrive internationally, not just at U.S. ports, but to other ports to assure their citizens the safety and security and their well-being in this world of global terrorism. In the case of the Coast Guard, we have activities that actually do begin overseas, very similar to customs, but not to the same extent. Part of our effort has been to examine overseas ports to see whether they have implemented ISPIS properly. We have completed 44 countries' visits of foreign ports, some of which DPW has. We've been to DPW ports as well in four of these countries and have found them to comply with the International Port Security Code. We've also found seven countries that have not met those international standards, in which time we go to the State Department and we issue demarches. And then that places basically restrictions or additional requirements for vessels that want to visit those ports. And if they don't take those actions when they arrive here, we turn those vessels away and then have an audit of the vessel and clearance of those cargoes if that transpires. The idea that, as he said, as Admiral Lloyd mentioned, that they're managing any entity that runs a terminal, runs port security, is a fallacy. However, they do have responsibility for internal operations on their facilities if they are, in fact, terminal owners. In some cases, DPW basically runs stevedoring services, which don't have responsibility for security. And in some cases, there is, in fact, as he's indicated, there's port authorities that have law enforcement personnel and have primary security responsibilities. I'd also offer that the vessels, before they arrive, they're targeted. In addition, you'll hear from Jay about the cargo targeting system, but the vessel 96 hours in advance, we receive information on the previous ports of call, the crew that's on board, the cargo manifest, as well as any passengers that might be on board the vessel. That allows us to vet 96 hours in advance so that we could intercept that offshore if we felt there was a need to do so. We boarded 16,000 ships since July 2004 when the Marine Transportation Security Act and the ISPIS code was put into place. We've taken 143 control actions where we have expelled vessels or we've told vessels they cannot come into U.S. ports in those cases. In fact, we had one yesterday that arrived in New Orleans the company security firm that it was represented was a false representation, and an individual on board was a known felon. The vessel was turned away and not allowed to come into U.S. ports. From the facility side, likewise, it's not that these people are left to their own devices. In addition to what you'll hear Jay talk about, we confirm MTSA, the Marine Transportation Security Act, place specific requirements on the facilities in these ports and the terminal operators to carry out security. A large portion of that is physical security and perimeter security access control. It also has responsibilities for their interface with the vessel so that when the vessel arrives, it's the security, there's a linkage there between the vessel's responsibility and the facility's responsibility. In those cases, we've had 700 violations, and we've had 44 cases where we've either shut down the facility or we've restricted cargo ops as a result of problems. The idea, again, that no one's watching and that these people can do whatever they want with their operations is false. The other thing is, if Jay or our Customs and Border Protection or the Coast Guard or the intelligence community identifies particular threats, these vessels will be boarded offshore, and the large portions of our boardings are, in fact, conducted offshore. So, again, there's a very comprehensive process. The Coast Guard, with our Captain of the Port authorities, has the authority to stop, board, turn away any vessel that presents a threat or any individual who presents a threat. We have the same authority with regard to the facilities. We could shut down all operations at any facility at any time we found it to be provide some risk to the security of the United States.
Thank you. What you're hearing this morning are important facts. Facts not generally known to the American people or large segments of the American people. And it's unfortunate that they are learning about it in a kind of a backward way as they go from worst case conditions to recognizing that a great deal of thought and effort and preparation has gone into the administration of this CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States. For my sins, I am currently the acting chair of the Advisory Council on Homeland Security, which President Bush established in 2001. I see Ruth David, who heads one of the important task forces in this area, is present this morning. Admiral Ambassador David Abshire, who founded CSIS along with others, heads another important task force having to do with sea time security from threats from the sea. People have been working on these problems, and, of course, the operators, both Customs and the Coast Guard, have been vigorously involved and are involved. When I first heard this problem emerging, I thought to myself, my memory went back to my experience with a situation called CISPUS, which some of you have probably long forgotten if ever you remember. But I was in the process of going from the FBI to the CIA when it broke, and it had something to do with my confirmation process, but not much. But it had to do with an operation in which the FBI was looking into reports from an informant that an organization known as CISPUS, which purported to be raising money to support widows and orphans in El Salvador, was actually raising money to support terrorist activities there, very much the same kind of allegations that had to do with the PIRA in Ireland. The guidelines for the administration of that project were set up by former Attorney General Edward Levy. They call for specific kinds of notification, process, and so forth. There was no no investigation in the sense of wiretapping or physical surveillance of the members of CISPAS, but we were looking for, on the basis of informant information, anything that was in the field offices that would be helpful to us. And the supervisor of the desk, following the guidelines, kept expanding his search because he wasn't finding anything. Pretty soon all 59 field offices were reporting what they had on file. The Justice Department weighed in. We all decided there was – they decided that there was no need to continue it, and it was over until it broke, much like the one we're dealing with today. It turned out that the informant was sour, the information was bad. The problem was that the members of CISPAS were all ministers and priests, which raised a specter of considerable concern to the American people and Congress, and justifiably so. Why this occurred in the way that it did was there was no requirement in the guidelines that the supervisor advise people upstairs of what they were doing, what was being done, because they were simply looking at records. But it was thought to be, particularly given the membership, a threatening thing. And I credit the I thought it would be nice if he had thought this is something the director might want to know about. But at the same time, I'm sure the president may have thought that more recently in terms of the port situation. But it was a credit to them that there was nothing political about it. It was totally apolitical. And this committee, so far as I can determine, has been operating in a totally professional and apolitical manner. It just didn't occur to any of the 12 members that this was apt to be, when the word was out about this shift in control of the people holding the contracts, that this might be misunderstood by people who did not understand the care and efforts that went into putting it together. I thought it was remarkable that they, in their work, that they had come to a total consensus. Back in the days when I used to work on something called COCOM, which was similar, but it had to do with our controlling our exports into areas that might affect our national security, that we were almost never in agreement. You could count on the CIA and the defense to oppose it and the State Department and Commerce to support it. Here there were 12 committee people who looked at it seriously and professionally. The one thing was missing is they did not see. They were tone deaf on the issue of popular misunderstanding of what was going on. And I hope that in the course of this discussion we'll recognize that a certain level of transparency is always advisable when you're dealing with sensitive issues, and that if you get out in front of the problem before it occurs, that the leadership of the Congress is usually responsive. Certainly in the intelligence side, the House and the Senate select committees act as surrogates not only for the Congress but for the American people, and information can be provided. CFIS provides executive order and so forth for confidentiality, but I don't believe that it requires confidentiality about the fact of a change of lease. It might have to do with some of the operational instruction that the admiral is giving as a condition for his support. But we do need some kind of understanding that these things have political potential, and I'd say not political, not in a partisan sense, although partisan issues have more recently emerged on the security side, but simply because concern about how my folks out in the country are going to feel about them types of people coming in to do our work, particularly if it had to do with security and they were going to be in a position to subvert the good work of the Coast Guard and Customs. My one suggestion before I turn over for more discussion is that we look toward a way of making sure that those who do this work that it passes through someone who's got a little more finely tuned ear and says, we should be talking to the leaders in Congress about this now. Not that we need their authority to do it, but that we need them to know that we've done our homework and that this is the right thing to do. And I'm sure we'll hear from the others that they have looked at the new prospective operators of these leases and find that they are associated with a country that has been exceedingly cooperative with our country in some very difficult and tempestuous times, and probably as consistently cooperative as any country among our traditional allies. I think that's enough for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First off, I want to thank CSIS and David for putting together a panel like this to put some visibility on an issue which I think that we really need to continue discussion on. I think it's also important for me to begin with kind of a disclaimer. I'm not a member of the administration. I'm a 30-year veteran within Customs and now Customs and Border Protection. So I represent kind of 30 years of operational experience looking at these issues from a variety of different perspectives over the years. And it's very important that we talk about this and look at the process that went into considering the security factors in this business transaction. And certainly I wouldn't disagree with Judge Webster that obviously we needed to have our political intent a little bit more throughout the process. But I want to just kind of talk to some of the operational issues. First, I think it's important for everyone in this room and certainly the public to continue to understand that the security of the homeland, the people in this country, are the first and foremost priority of the Department of Homeland Security, Secretary Chertoff, and certainly the component heads that have security of this country. That has never wavered. That is something we're always committed to. And every decision we make, we consider the security of this country first. As I take a look also to Admiral Loy's question or point about here we are now 4.5 years later, we kind of reached a moment where we need to actually integrate more. Do we need to come up with a next-generation strategy? Do we need to consider engaging private sector more? I think all the answers to those things are certainly yes. But it's not to discredit the work that's gotten to this point, which I think are important to just outline very, very briefly. Given the tragic events of 9/11, there was obviously a rapid need to increase the security of this country in all vectors. And certainly as we're talking about the maritime model, I'd like to just lay out some things very quickly that perhaps we can have some more discussion or take some questions on later in a post-9/11 environment. For Customs and Border Protection, we felt it was critically important for us to first take the mission to the foreign soil, defense in depth, if you will. And certainly we felt it was critical to make our U.S. ports here in the United States not the first time that we encounter a container or a maritime transaction as it's arriving in our shores. We felt it was important to have a defense-in-depth strategy, take our resources, take our technology, take our information as early in that transportation process as we possibly can. So as such, we deployed the Container Security Initiative. We began first with a pilot program in Canada, and now today we're in 42 countries around the world. And through those 42 ports, one of which is the Port of Dubai, by the way, that came online in March of 2005, through those 42 ports, we have about 75% of the container traffic coming to the United States through those ports. We also felt if we're going to put assets on the ground there, we need to have information for them to go ahead and have an ability to target and use for risk assessment purposes. So through the 24-hour rule and the Trade Act, we had the ability to go ahead and mandate and require 24 hours prior to lading manifest information so we can then have that electronically transmitted to a centralized location here in the United States, just outside of Washington, D.C., to risk score using intelligence information and risk-based algorithm, 100% of all manifest information relative to the cargo shipments coming by vessel into the United States to score them for risk. We then would have those particular containers that score risk. Then, through declaration of principles, we've now reached with 42 countries and assets on the ground, work with the host country counterparts to go ahead and resolve the risk, either providing new information or targeting factors to mitigate the risk. And if we're not able to, then deploy our resources with the host country nation counterparts using high-energy X-ray systems to be able to X-ray a container and using radiation detection capabilities to see if there's any radiation emitting in that box, to include a physical inspection if necessary. We also felt it was important to engage the private sector very early in this process. So in April of 2002, we engaged the private sector in the Customs Trade Partnership Against Terrorism. So we now have over 10,000 members. Only 5,800 are certified members at this point. that we actually have engaged where we believe one of the greatest points of vulnerability is even outside of the ports in a foreign location. That's the point of stuffing. So we now have our validation specialists that have gone out and done validations in a considerable amount of companies overseas, point of stuffing, high-risk locations, so that we can actually validate the business practices they have in place, the background practices they have, the security practices and the protocols they have to stuff and secure a container from that premises before it even arrives in a port overseas for destination in the United States. So there's three distinct layers we've put overseas, and every single one of those programs were non-existent pre-9/11. And those are important points for everyone to realize. Radiation detection capabilities. Certainly, we have that as part of the protocols overseas, but also we're at the point now of deploying here in the United States. First, we went and deployed radiation portal monitors, drive-through size type portal monitors on our border with Canada. Why did we go there first? Because we didn't have those three steps that I just spoke of in a maritime model, and we had concerns with what might be or who might be in Canada. It's not to go ahead and challenge or speak pejoratively at all about our friends to the north, very strong relationships we have, but given the business transactions, we wanted to make sure we had a good risk model in place, and we didn't have the ability through advanced information to screen prior to a truck arriving at our border. So we had our radiation portal monitors deployed on the northern border, and today 90% of the trucks coming across the border from Canada are run through radiation portal detection. So we have that ability. Southern border, we're at about 85%. Now swinging back to the maritime model that we're currently focused on, we have 181 radiation portal monitors deployed at our seaports today. Total footprint we need is about 621. So we're looking at 37% of the container traffic. Please don't do the math and say 181 of 621 does not come out to be 37%. We're looking at the container traffic that goes through those RPMs. And that's one of the tail ends of the process, because overseas, get the information, go to point of stuffing, go to point of lading, and also once it's then departs a port in the United States, have the ability to scan it one more time for radiation before it's then entered into the commerce of the United States. A real key piece in between there also is our Customs and Border Protection officers, the equipment they're deployed with, their skill, their training, and also the X-ray systems and the radiation detection system we have to go ahead and do a dockside control, positive control of the cargo as it arrives here in the United States. So I think these are some of the strategies I think that are out there. Please don't let anyone believe that we're comfortable where we are, or that we don't need to do more. We're constantly challenging ourselves. I think also at this point in time, we do need to integrate more with other components within the Department of Homeland Security, within other government agencies in this country to get more information to screen, have an ability to cross-reference some of the information that we have, doing our risk scoring better, but also engage the private sector with what more can they do to bring to bear the resources and the capabilities we might have, again, further overseas. We can talk about some of those aspects as well, what we can do to, again, score and risk and vet and actually use technologies earlier in the process to complement the programs we already have in place. So I think I'll stop there, David.
Okay, thank you. There's a number of issues you've all raised that I want to try to integrate and see if we can get to some clarity on the facts. Admiral Loy, you started with the question of what is a port and what role DP World will be playing in that. Admiral Bone and Commissioner Ahern talked about a number of, for those of you who are uninitiated in Washington, alphabets. We've got CT, PATH, and CSI, 24-hour rules and 96-hour rules. Those are very important security programs that are in place, and I want to get into some more details about that. And Judge Webster, you talked about the importance of the UAE, United Arab Emirates, as an ally in the war against terrorism, and I want to get to that as well. I think maybe one of the ways we can approach that is to take a look at the greatest concern that people have about terrorism today is the threat of a nuclear device being smuggled into the United States, perhaps on a cargo, in a cargo container aboard a ship. And I wonder if maybe we could take just a couple minutes and work through from abroad to loading a ship abroad to coming to the United States, what security is in place to make sure that doesn't happen, and who's doing that security? And I'll open it to...
Jay, you want to take the first crack?
Be happy to. Again, just to put a little more granularity on the layers I spoke about. Again, we don't want the ports here in the United States to be the first opportunity for the government to intervene. So in 42 ports overseas, we now have Customs and Border Protection assets working there with host country counterparts to screen containers of risk using high energy systems and radiation detection capabilities overseas. We also have validations that have been conducted in locations throughout the world, looking at the point of stuffing of suppliers, vendors, manufacturers who import here to the United States. That, again, gives us where we think some of the greatest vulnerability is at point of stuffing.
So loading the containers.
Loading the containers for transit down to the port for lading on a vessel to come into the United States. So that's a key distinction. The layers of technology we have, the radiation detection capabilities, I spoke of 37% as something's departing a port into the commerce of the United States. We have that capability there. So there's many different layers that one would have to go through to get a container that could have WMD or WME coming into the United States. And it certainly makes the challenge much greater. Is it risk-free? No, it's not. And do we need to do better? Absolutely. We need to continue to move forward with finalizing and completely implementing the strategy we have in place. We need to look to engage private sector more. But, again, I think that there's a very good foundation for a system in place that we need to continue to build upon.
Of the containers that you talked about, the pre-screening in countries abroad, in ports abroad, how much of that would DP World have a role in?
Well, DP World, again, is in March of this year, the Port of Dubai, which DP World actually controls and manages. It was a member of our CSI, our Container Security Initiative. And I hate to use the acronyms, and I'll try to define them as we go here as well. But the Container Security Initiative, they became one of our active members in March of this year. So they're actually involved with, again, the management of the port and the terminal in that particular area. And they're providing assets through the port authorities there to deal with our counterparts.
Does the deal, though, add any additional role for DP World in the security you just described?
The assurances or vulnerabilities that were provided as part of the CFIUS process did call for some additional assurances, which were making some of these programs that I talked about voluntary. They're currently voluntary programs. We actually put as part of the assurance process, making them mandatory.
Okay.
Mandatory membership in CTPAT, continued mandatory membership in the Container Security Initiative.
Offer something that I believe to be true, and someone can contradict me if it isn't, but it's an important distinction. I'm informed that the DC World employees do not touch the cargo. The cargo comes in sealed containers under the control of our security, not theirs. And I think that's generally needs to be known.
The DP World may very well hire stevedoring firms, yeah, and other, or they may even manage stevedoring firms that P&O currently manages, and they'll be taking over those operations as well, which means those individuals will be moving containers.
But
not the security for stuffing, loading, mm-hmm, not responsible for any sense of, quote, security around that, other than, again, the gate guard. You know, there are, in fact, quite often, if you run and manage a terminal, you'll have some responsibility for access control unless it's provided by the Port Authority itself, and usually that's an agreement between the terminal and the Port Authority.
Let me tell you what they don't do and won't do and haven't done. They don't control the point of stuffing. That's, again, suppliers, vendors, manufacturers, where a container is stuffed for transport to the United States. They don't affix the seal on that container at the point of stuffing. They will be there when the container gets delivered to a port overseas and will be placed in a terminal, which they would manage, and held for lading into the United States when the vessel is ready to be laden. That could be 2, 3, 4 days prior to lading. They do not control the information that's transmitted to the United States government 24 hours in advance. They're not involved or made aware of the scores for risk of those particular containers, and they're not involved with the X-raying or the imaging that goes on, or the radiation scanning of those containers overseas or in the United States. So those are things they're definitely not involved with. They're a handler.
Yeah, let me just add also, they're not responsible for any of the security or even knowledge of the security operations that Customs, the Coast Guard, and the other local state law enforcement agencies are carrying out to basically address security in the port. And that's also been kind of misrepresented as if now they'll have access to all the security operations. They'll know what and how we carry out those operations. The only people that actually know that are law enforcement entities or those that carry security clearances. And the other thing, one of the other things from the assurances that we've been provided is information that will be provided about the individuals and the people operating within the DPW terminals. And that, again, allows for us to conduct our own background investigation to whatever degree we believe necessary to vet those individuals.
The notion of the people thing just offers us a chance to reinforce that original portrait I tried to begin to paint for you. It's about people, cargo, conveyances, and facilities. Each of those, in turn, has been covered if you sort of kept up with the commentary from both Jay and Admiral Bone. The notion that I would also offer is that this is not frozen in time. To the degree Jay speaks of capabilities in terms of technical resources available at the moment, we are also investing an awful lot of effort in what I'd call the next generation technical capability. So to the degree there is a X-ray drive-through system in place either overseas, along with this notion of pushing the borders out and having our ports really be the last touch we have with those containers or those ships or those people, and that we want first encounters way over there, that push the borders out notion, I hope that message got out very clearly. But the challenge associated with that goes to people, conveyances, cargo, and facilities, both in the overseas point and at the point of arrival here into the United States. So the system that we're concerned about is literally a point of origin to a point of destination. It's at the manufacturing plant in Germany to the Walmart warehouse in Iowa City. And the transparency along the way, along that supply chain, as it's referred to, all of which offers opportunities for mischief and challenges for the security implications that both these gentlemen are responsible for. So it's not something that has just dawned on us as a result of the DP World transaction. It's stuff that we have been working very, very diligently on from the days well before 9/11, but 9/11, of course, really enhanced the efforts being undertaken. But this notion of where we are today and where we might be 2 years from now, 5 years from now, it is a progression towards greater security inside the envelope that allows commerce in this global marketplace to continue to flow. Because that, after all, is the foundation for, in the United States and around the world, the quality of life that we all enjoy.
If I could just add to that a little bit, and that is, we refer to maritime domain awareness, and that is looking at who and what's moving through the system. And as you talk about, a lot of what we're talking about here is legitimate cargoes, legitimate companies that have invested a lot of money to provide for security for the American public in moving their cargoes in through this system. We have to be, and our concerns likewise, Coast Guard and Customs and Border Protection and ICE, look at those that aren't so forthright and forward and may not provide that information. And those vessels that would not register 96 hours in advance. And we look at systems such as long-range identification tracking and the automated identification system, and these systems so that we can see, again, offshore what's moving through our waterways, who identifying friend from foe, so to speak, if you think in military terms, or that which is highest risk from lowest risk, so that we target and intervene. We have the ability to detect, deter, and thwart any type of attempt. Last, I just say that just one more thing just in the supply chain is that the manifest, part of the boarding offshore, is in fact to confirm the manifest information and the targeting information that's been provided to Customs and Border Protection is in fact accurate. And intelligence may come in at any time. And the ability basically to intercept based on any current intelligence a particular asset or a vessel is critical in this system.
Let me go to what Admiral Loy talked about in terms of the four areas of security that we're concerned about, and particularly people, because I think that the one thing that a lot of discussion has centered around is people, that there could be infiltration, that there could be because of the business transaction, individuals who work in the business who might have special knowledge or connections that could be problematic. Can we talk about what security is in place to protect against people being involved, I guess, as insiders to help in the smuggling effort? Particularly, how do we know that – what kind of background checks do we do, and will that change in any way? And Judge Webster, I'd also like to get to you in terms of how do we – just from maybe the FBI perspective, after Customs and Coast Guard have looked into these issues, how do we also do some other stuff? Are there other things going on the FBI is looking at in terms of threat on a general basis in our ports? But go ahead, Jay.
Well, I think I can get in and out of this one pretty quickly.
Okay.
I hope there. The nobody works for DC World in the United States and its American subsidiary, unless they are a United States citizen or possess a official visa to come. So that's a beginning point where vetting takes place. Any other kind of vetting results from information provided from other sources that provides a reasonable grounds to believe that someone is behaving against the interests of the United States. And you can do the usual things provided you have the appropriate probable cause and get the warrants for what you need to do to check that out.
Admiral White, on the background investigations, the Department of Homeland Security, when you were there, had looked at a program, the Transportation Workers Identification Credential, TWIC. There's another four-letter word. That was supposed to be the standard for assuring that people who were working in transportation mm-hmm. modalities were of cleared in terms of background investigation. That hasn't come through yet, and so you're seeing states like Florida develop their own background checks, mm-hmm. and it's really catch-as-catch-can. Do we have to do more in terms of background investigations, and where's the department today, if you know?
Well, I can at least sketch it for you in terms of its complexity, and if either Jay or Craig can add anything more current, that's fine. The whole notion of the people piece is about credentialing, and it's an extraordinarily difficult challenge across the board. There's really sort of two things you're interested in the people piece. One is identity authentication. Are you who you claim to be? Now, are you David Heyman, the guy that sent me the letter? Is that the right guy that's still here at the desk in the morning? And so put that in the maritime marketplace as it relates to longshoremen, as it relates to masters, as it relates to crew members on ships, as it relates to passengers on those vessels as they might be coming to the United States. And the first order of business is identity authentication. Are the players who they claim to be? And then once you have passed that gate and you're satisfied through the credentialing process, whether that's with biometric enhancement, and we can go there in just a second. But the second order, then, is access control. Now that you know that the player is who they claim to be, what is the control of the access? Are they going to be allowed to go behind just the green door or the green door and the red door? Now, put this in an airport context, put this in a port context, put this in the security context of all of us that walk through the lobby this morning, all of us who go to an airport to get on a plane. Those people issues are usually just those two, identity authentication, access control. You mentioned the TWIC program. The Transportation Workers Identity Credential was born in TSA when TSA was being stood up as a brand new organization, because we saw at the beginning that this people piece of the overall challenge was going to be a very demanding one. There were also challenges that were going on elsewhere in government. For example, we all recall that the 9/11 players often got their flight training here in the United States. So all of a sudden there was, not all of a sudden, but all of a sudden immediately after 9/11, there was a great concern as to how we vet foreign students that would be likely to be able to attend flight training opportunities here in the United States. A vetting process was put together with all of the agencies and government responsible to figure out how best we were going to do that, if you will, a credentialing process. I took a delegation to the International Maritime Organization on the 15th of November 2001, 2 months after 9/11, to go and generate the ISPIS code that Craig spoke about earlier. We took 14 points in our agenda to that session. two of which we did not get completed in the ISPIS code. One of them was about containers, which had to go to the World Customs Organization to find international standards to be set, and the second one was about people and credentialing, which had to go to the International Labor Organization to have international standards set. But in the meantime, here in the States, we were working diligently on programs like TWIC, like vetting truck drivers to carry hazardous materials, like vetting would-be foreign students to go to aviation training centers here in the United States. And I believe we have come to a point where the department has recognized this, the common ground of a credentialing or screening kind of a across-the-board challenge that we had. And we have not completed TWIC, although we have a good system for vetting hazardous material, truck drivers, and foreign students in aviation centers. I think the challenge of the moment is to pull all of that screening and credentialing work together so there's common effort across the board. And we all understand our sort of reluctance to have a national ID card, but the notion of what could constitute a standard set of identity requirements and then allow the players that have to deal with such things as both Craig and Jay have to deal with, work through that application in their world of work.
Just the TWIC card is actually responsibility for the TWIC. It actually lies with the Transportation Security Administration. But the Marine Transportation Security Act required the Coast Guard to implement the TWIC card. And one thing that's important is the TWIC is, in fact, identification document. We are looking at using biometrics in that. It is a priority of the Secretary to have this issued. I can tell you that directly. It is we will be seeing rulemaking shortly on this. As in people have actually had drafts already in play on this. It's not something new. As you mentioned, Florida actually was paid for partially by grant dollars, by federal port security grant dollars, and a prototype, as well as a few other locations that TSA engaged in. And as Admiral Loy said, it's not limited in any case to maritime. However, maritime will be the first place that it's employed. And it is a critical area. We believe it is critical to have it employed in order to close some vulnerabilities.
If I may add, one of the things from the very beginning was to make sure all the stakeholders were at the table. In other words, this is not going to be one of those things at the end when it's issued that all of a sudden labor is going to stand up and say, hey, we weren't part of that from the very beginning, so forget it. We're not going to have our longshoremen or our these or our those involved in the process. They were participating members of the design team at the beginning and have, in the instances of Los Angeles, Long Beach, and the Philadelphia, Wilmington, Delaware ports, been involved from the very beginning. And the wholesomeness of that is that all the players have their oar in the water from the very beginning and are actually there to help us design the right capability to credential folks in these circumstances.
Okay, so that just to summarize that, this is a responsibility of the federal government. It's not complete yet, but it is not a responsibility of DP World.
Oh, absolutely not.
No, it's not a responsibility of DP World, but we're not waiting for the TWIC when it comes to DP World with regard to the assurances on
okay.
the people.
Okay, I want to move on, and then I want to open up for questions. One last point, and Judge Webster brought this up earlier, about the role of the United Arab Emirates in this. This is the DP World is a state-owned organization, and some members, we've heard from some members of Congress, let me read you a quote here, in terms of nuclear smuggling, this was identified as a transfer point for nuclear components from Pakistani scientists to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. And somebody was quoted as saying, if UAE couldn't produce security in their own country to stop the transiting of such nuclear components, why in God's name would we give them the operation of the ports? Now, that's an inflammatory statement, but I think it gets to the concerns that people have, which is the role of a government that was not perhaps cognizant of, aware of, or caring about nuclear smuggling, and now having a management responsibility for a corporation. Can you speak to those issues, anyone?
I'll take an initial crack at it. what's on the table should be a focus on the transaction and the responsibilities associated with the exchange, if you will, in terms of who's going to be doing what after the transaction is either confirmed or denied. As to the notion that you heard in the quote, or that two of the 9/11 hijackers were from the UAE, those kind of inflammatory statements, I don't think gather help to help us go where we want to go. I mean, the same thing could be said for those 9/11 hijackers that spent a good portion of their lives before 9/11 right here in the United States. So whether, you know, do we also excise California, Arizona, New York, and New Jersey away from the consideration process of what we're doing here for the same kind of a reasoning set? And of course, the quasi-racism kind of intonation to the thing, that if it's from UAE, read Arab, read Middle East, there's something inherently erroneous about it as a foundation participant in the business of managing a port operator's responsibilities. I just think all of that rhetoric is the kerosene in the air that is driving us to an inability to sit down and reason toward a final judgment. If you look specifically at the UAE, because of their progressive nature as a state, as a country, if you go back and ask the NATO commanders in Kosovo whether or not they enjoyed the opportunity to have UAE helicopters and troops on the ground as peacekeepers for them in the course of the deliberations and the responsibilities to be played out there, my guess is that you would get a very favorable answer. So is the Congress right in asking the questions? Absolutely. Is the CFIUS process internally, did it adequately address those questions? A question that the 45-day clock now offers us a chance to clarify to everyone's satisfaction. But we don't want to be in the business of sort of stereotypically typecasting the yes or no up front. Let's put facts on the table and resolve them on the basis of that.
Thank you. I think we're going to open up for questions now. There are microphones around. If you could raise your hand, identify yourself, and if you're with an organization, your affiliation. So there's a question right here. Before we bring the microphone around, I just want to also on the UAE point, I want to say I believe that in 1999 in the Kosovo operations, they were the only Middle Eastern country that provided troops to the operation.
Yes, thank you. I'm Frank Besson, an independent consultant. Thank you all very much. Very enlightening. My specialties are port operations and port security, and another four-letter word, which I want to ask our two admirals about, and it's FOCI, Foreign Ownership, Control, or Influence. Now, this is a law on the books of the United States, as is a law that Senator Biden mentioned that requires a port and terminal operator to have a security plan. And clearly, it ought to be integrated with the Coast Guard and, the customs folks who are doing the work there. So really my question is, are you familiar with FOCI? Are you aware that there is a procedure for foreign governments to either own, control, operate, or influence? And influence is the critical thing, I think, that is bothering a lot of the Congress. But this has precedent with the government of France. Renault bought the fourth largest, my company, American Motors. That's exactly right, and we don't have them anymore because Renault's got them. But one of the subsidiaries was AM General Corporation, and they had a confidential clearance because we made military vehicles. And so in order to allow this transaction to take place, the Secretary of the Army, then Marty Hoffman, and a few of us, and very few, did the first corporate governance, American corporate governance, American firewalls, maybe even some sort of blind trust. It's fairly simple and easy. So my question to both of you, sir, are you familiar with FOCI? Are you familiar with that as a possible solution to this? It could be a win-win-win for everybody. I know, Admiral Bone, you said that they do not have access to the classified classified portions or to the security operations of Customs and the Coast Guard. But I should think we would want them to, so that they know what we know and we know what they know, but it would be insulated from the corporation by this corporate governance. So that's my question to you, Tim. Thank you very much.
I don't know to what degree in the immediate CFIUS process review, which of course I was not part of, FOCI legal implications were on the table to be reviewed. Maybe Craig can answer that question, maybe he can't. What I can tell you is that the CFIUS process, by definition, was among those put together so as to acknowledge legislative requirements with respect to foreign investment. And therefore, in all those that I was a part of, those elements were on the table, and we addressed them head on in the due course of the deliberations to a CFIUS decision.
I concur exactly with what he says. What I'd offer, though, is when you're looking at the solution here, when we talk about, and we shouldn't just be looking at this one port, operations center, this terminal. When the Marine Transportation Security Act actually put into place requirements for each facility to have facility security plans and also delineate within that plan facility company security officer, the facility security officer, and the people within that security environment. There's an ability there to create a firewall between the security operations and the other operation sets within the port so that they won't be compromised by someone with ill intent. That, coupled with an area maritime security plan that looks at the overall port, all the terminal, all the waterside operation sets, is also in place. That's a constant, ongoing, addressing daily the threat streams and the procedures that need to be put in place. At different threat levels, there's different sets of actions that are required both by the federal, state, and local entities as well as the facility security officers. They need to know about their responsibilities, their actions to be carried out, and only the degree to which that corresponds with someone who may come to assist them. They don't need to know what happens at an oil terminal. They don't need to know what happens outside of their gates other than to know the degree of assistance that they can count on with regard to it. And those individuals that know, I will say, particular areas, sensitive areas within the security plan, because you're right, it has to be an integrated for the region, not just for individual facilities. Those people receive classified clearances and also have SSI or law enforcement sensitive background done.
Thank you. In the back. Bring a microphone to the back. Thanks.
Hello, Eric Coolish, American Shipper Magazine. A couple days ago, a Coast Guard memo came out, an internal memo that raised some security questions during the review process about intelligence gaps that the Coast Guard couldn't close on Dubai Ports World. Subsequent to that, in January, the Coast Guard started or maybe restarted doing some audits or visiting some of the P&O port facilities here. Explain to me why we shouldn't read into that follow-up as an effort to close those intelligence gaps kind of post-review and as opposed to closing them before. And maybe you could just explain the how Coast Guard Intelligence or the Intelligence Coordination Center works.
Yeah. Well, first off, the document or the information you're talking about is a document that was a classified assessment that was being done well before this acquisition took place in an agency level due diligence. What you saw was what was pulled out of that was basically three statements that were unclassified in a classified document that again, you can take out of context. What also wasn't said at the closure of that assessment was, in fact, that the Coast Guard found at the closure of that assessment that there was no significant threat to U.S. ports as a result of DPW acquiring P&O. Again, that was done as part of the process of a Coast Guard process as an agency within the Department Department of Homeland Security, who represents the basically is one of the 12 members in the CFIUS process. So what we're talking about here is a small element. And as due diligence, as you look and say, what are the things that you're concerned about? The current effort that's being looking at P&O ports is really baselining to make sure as DPW takes over, that DPW cannot make a assertion that they have any security problems as a result of what they took over, and that they had, in fact, acquired an entity that had security problems to begin with. So what that effort really is, which has been completed, was, in fact, baseline. It had absolutely nothing to do with the document. The conclusion in the document that you're referring to, again, a classified document, I can't go into the specifics of how all of those were resolved, but I can tell you that the operations portion and the people portions of that were resolved by the assurances letter that were provided as part of the CFIUS process.
I'm Toby Eckert with Copley Newspapers. The question that Mr. Heyman raised about the UAE being used as a transit point for nuclear component smuggling from Pakistan was not answered. How big of a concern should that be in this process?
I don't know that I'm adequately informed factually about either the assertion or the notion as to whether or not it ought to be part of the decision-making process here. To the degree the question has been raised, my guess is that the 45-day review also offers a chance to resolve any concerns with respect to that. But I don't have anything on a personal basis that from an intelligence background, for example, that would help you all understand that the assertion is a sound one.
Let me ask you this: Was DPW at all implicated in the transit of nuclear materials?
Not that I'm aware of.
That did not come up in the CFIUS
review. And I think that's an important point, because I just want to speak with some facts here again as far as what DPW work world does at the Port of Dubai. Is basically provides stevedoring services, terminal operating services. They do not know what's in containers. They do not have access to the manifest and the detail information, as was testified on at least before one committee this week, that they have no knowledge of what's in the container. So for them to go ahead and intervene and make an assessment, they're incapable of doing that, and that's not stated pejoratively. That's just not their function or their responsibility.
Let me take it another way. If the United Arab Emirates somehow was involved in the nuclear transit, is there a way that they could influence DPW and smuggle materials through their port system as a result of this transaction?
Let me just state that the intelligence community's responsibility is to look at all threat vectors that this organization could present and identify any set of scenarios, not limited in any way. And my expectation is that we had the full, when you look at who's on the CFIUS process, you have the ability and the capability and the individuals and the organizations they represent to carry that out. My expectation was that that was done. I have no reason to believe it wasn't considered. And I have, as such, I would have no basis to say that there's a problem.
And Negroponte testified to that yesterday, so thank you.
That's what I got to ask.
Okay, right up here, up front. We'll try to get two more questions quickly. So why don't we ask your question? We'll ask, there's one back there, and then we'll see if we can wrap it up.
I'm Justine Redman with CNN. My question is to Mr. Abraham. Yesterday, Senator Schumer said that he had information that before the DP World deal was approved, that Customs had concerns, security concerns about the deal. Can you confirm whether or not that was the case? He also said that DHS ignored those concerns. Is that the case, and if so, what were the concerns?
I have heard of Senator Schumer's allegation yesterday. I also learned that he was not able to produce any document or reliable source on that. I was the individual who cleared on this process within Customs and Border Protection. I reviewed all the material, and there was no derogatory or any hesitation on our part from moving forward with supporting this decision.
Thank you, Jay. Right here. Sathek.
Hi. I'm Seth Stotter. I'm from Macon Gump. But before that, my other hat was I served as Director of Policy and Planning for CBP after 9/11, and so I was pretty deeply involved in CSI and CTPAT and 24-hour rule and all that with Commissioner Bonner and Jay. And Earl Loy.
So it's illegitimate now for you to ask your question.
Yeah. No,
please hand the microphone to the person next to you.
No, I have a tough question for you all, which is, I mean, I think that the 45 days is going to give, hopefully, an opportunity for us all in the media and Congress and otherwise to think about what are the real issues with regard to seaport security and port security and container security. But I think that one of the things that I've been sort of wrestling with is somewhat presaged by Admiral Loy's point of thinking about what's the big picture, what's the integrated whole of the system. And I think one of the things that I think that people don't quite understand, and I don't understand myself, and I think it's sort of something we need to think about, is what's the end goal? What's our end state? What's the level of security that we want in a system? Because we could have maximal security by just shutting down global trade. And so what's the issue? What are we aiming for? Are we aiming for a type of security that will prevent all types of attacks? Are we aiming for a type of security that will deter attacks using this system so the terrorists go elsewhere? Are we aiming for a system that protects the United States? Are we aiming for a system that protects global trade, Western Hemisphere, whatever? What's essentially the answer to that?
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
I think the reality is we all live in a very different security environment post 9/11, and the security environment is now composed of threats and vulnerabilities even that we did not give an awful lot of attention to in the pre 9/11 days. It's a very different kind of enemy. You know, no king, no borders, no president, no flag, no whatever. And so the notion of whatever rules, quote unquote, had applied to the Cold War or to hot wars of the past have very little application to what we're trying to grapple with in this new security, post 9/11 security environment. And so to that end, we attempt to optimize that which we cannot guarantee. And there are no guarantees. On a daily basis, we live in a world now dramatically different in terms of risk than has ever been the case before. And so our challenge, those of us who find ourselves in the online positions or trying to make a contribution from whatever chair we sit in, is to find the right package that optimizes that set of things you just described. It is to optimize global trade. It is to optimize security. It is to optimize civil liberties. One of the things that Governor Ridge and I attempted to do, and I'm sure Secretary Chertoff and Secretary Jackson continue to insist on, when we have a proposal come to the front office, so to speak, in the department, and it is a proposal to increase security, whatever that means, in any of these countless sectors of challenge that that confront the Secretary, we ask that the conversation always be about security balanced with commerce, balanced with civil liberties. Those are the things that we value as Americans. We value our quality of life with the economic underpinning and foundation that the global marketplace now represents, and we value the constitutional guarantees that were provided to us by our founding fathers. So we must keep in mind when we are considering an uptick in security, at what cost to either economic realities or civil liberties realities, and make good reasoned judgments to help us step forward into this almost world of the unknown, so to speak, which this new security environment of post 9/11 dictates for us.
Just to add to that, first off, it's good to see you haven't stopped asking the tough questions, Seth. You asked them internally as well, and Admiral Loy is exactly right. They did put us through the rigor of making sure as far as we continue to secure the homeland, we don't do it to the point where we choke off international travel and trade or increase the cost so much where we have economic damage in this country, because then the terrorist organizations win in another way.
They win.
So as we move forward to secure the country and secure these supply chains or trade lanes or travel lanes, we need to do it very thoughtfully. You know, one of the things that we are doing, and certainly we would love to continue to plug every hole and have whatever smuggling challenges we face in this country go elsewhere, but we continue to work that in a variety of different ways. One of the things that I didn't mention, which I think is important, is we need to take a look at this globally. And that's one of the things that Commissioner Bonner did before he departed was negotiated very, very aggressively with the World Customs Organization to get a global framework in place so that we get the 160-plus member nations of the World Customs Organization to accept basically the five elements of the strategy I talked about: advanced information, overseas application of resources, use of technology, private sector partnerships, and continuing to go ahead and enhance that through training of your resources. So we're aggressively involved with the stages of that as well, which will put that standard hopefully throughout the world and increase the safety and security of the maritime global supply chain. That's critical for us as we go forward. And from a business perspective, from carriers, traders in a global market, they don't want just one set of standards here in the United States and then a different one with the UK or the different one with the UAE and everyone else. They need to have a certain expectation of what is going to be required for manifest elements, electronic transmission capabilities, how are the resources going to be deployed in those environments. So there needs to be a much more, you know, standardization of that as we go forward. But it's an excellent point. It's certainly, you know, a challenge we continue to face, and it's one we continue to take head on.
I just offer that you have to realize that it could change based on threat. Today's environment is much different than it was pre-9/11. And that as threat changes, you have to – I think the real challenge is to create a system that can be flexible enough to respond to those changes in different directions. Because if we find that organizations and entities and their behavior and their investments move in another direction and there's no tolerance – internationally for individuals carrying out this truthfully, then we have a different environment again. So we could, though, have a much different environment going the other direction, even worse. So I think the responsibility of the government entities is to take into account what Admiral Loy said, but with the understanding that you may not have a lot of time to make adjustments if you need to.
Let me try to summarize a little bit of what we've heard today, and as we wrap it up, and I'm not going to be able to get to all the incredible points that were made, but trying to start from the beginning where the business venture is not about taking over U.S. ports, but it's about transference of leases on terminals that run the stevedore services for loading and unloading cargo. That's number one. Number two, in terms of security from starting from abroad where we have points of stuffing and we affix seals to the terminal where it's held and the 24-hour rule and x-raying and screening cargo, that is still the domain of the United States customs officials, and it is still the domain of the U.S. Coast Guard for boarding our ships offshore if need be, that the screening of personnel first and foremost, the visa process, and that secondary, that there we are still working on an identification program, that the Coast Guard has a program that they're doing right now. In terms of the programs like Container Security Initiative, CTPATH, and other security measures for cargo, you have gained some assurances from DP World that they are no longer going to be voluntary for them. They're going to be mandatory, and that the access control to facilities may be the domain of DP World, depending upon the port, and that there will still be continued law enforcement presence and state officials there. To summarize where we may be going, let me take from what Admiral Lloyd's saying, I believe that the focus of our efforts from loading containers in one port to unloading them here must be to ensure the transactions are secure. We have to look at transactions, regardless of the business of businesses whose cargo may be shipped, regardless of the citizenship of the dockhand, regardless of the flag on the vessel, and regardless of the nationality of the corporation that runs the operations. If our transaction's secure, we're secure, and I think that's the direction you said we're going. With that, let me thank all of our panelists for joining us and explaining a very complicated and hot issue. Thank the audience for your questions and your attention. And let's join me in a round for thanking the panelists.